High Noon, Hamburg, Pennsylvania, Campaign 08 comes down to a simple question.
If you were going to Alaska to hunt moose, which candidate would you want along with you, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama?
Neither.
I figured neither, but neither. If you had to
Barack
choose...
Barack Obama.
Barack Obama, why? Because he's a boy?
No, just because Hillary's more cocky.
Really?
Yes.
She'd make a lot of noise?
Yeah, a lot of digging and a lot of whatnot, yeah.
Yeah.
It's getting hard to ignore the enormous moose in the room. Outside of Cabela's Gun Store and Outfitters, wisdom for the dueling Democrats. Hey, guys, settle down. Those weapons are loaded. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
In other parts of the world, John, there's actual campaign news. In Paraguay, a new party will take charge after 60 years as voters went with the candidate for change. That sound familiar? In the U.S., neighbors are duking it out for the right to hang wet laundry.
Yay!
And oil prices hit a record today at $117 a barrel. Meanwhile, the Bush administration is stockpiling millions of gallons, and some say U.S. consumers are paying for a policy gone awry.
In other headlines, Pope Benedict is back at the Vatican after a six-day visit to the United States. He spent his last day celebrating Mass with a packed crowd at Yankee Stadium. Vice President Dick Cheney saw the Pope off at JFK Airport in New York.
Although you must leave us now, your words and the memory of this week will stay with us. For that, we are truly and humbly grateful.
Meanwhile, former President Jimmy Carter, on a visit to the Israeli-occupied Gaza Strip, says Hamas is prepared to accept the right of Israel to, quote, live as neighbor next door in peace. So far, no reaction from the Israeli government. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is also in the Middle East, asking Arab states to restore full diplomatic ties with Iraq. Rice is in Bahrain today for a meeting of the Gulf Cooperation Council.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says we need to produce more food to keep global prices from skyrocketing. He says high food prices could destabilize countries.
If not handled properly, this crisis could trigger a cascade of others and develop into multiple crises.
The Secretary General was speaking at a development conference in Ghana. He also pledged to set up a task force on the growing food crisis. In Zimbabwe, still no official results from the presidential election 3 weeks ago that the opposition says it won. There are growing reports of opposition supporters fleeing the country. Some estimate 1,000 people a day. The opposition party says President Robert Mugabe loyalists are systematically attacking their members, saying 500 have been assaulted and 10 killed.
Hillary Clinton's campaign is in the red. Finance reports show she owes $10 million, although the campaign has saved $9 million in cash for the Pennsylvania primary. The Barack Obama campaign kitty, meanwhile, has $42 million in the bank. Finally, a bit of gender equality when it comes to ascending the throne in the UK. British government planning to abolish an 18th century royal law that's favored men over women. That means male heirs will no longer have the right to succeed to the throne ahead of their older sisters.
It's about time.
There we go.
It's about time.
It's about time. But tomorrow is Earth Day.
It is. And how about the environment? There are just lists of ways you can help everywhere. It seems like a bit overwhelming.
We want to do something different. We want to hear your story of when you decided to take action and become green. Tell us the story, not an opinion. And you can leave your thoughts at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
What kind of things do you do? Carry plastic bags, yes or no?
Raise chickens.
Good answer.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
You're going to lead to me, John?
Well, good morning, Adora.
Yeah, and, good morning.
It's nice to be here in this pre-Earth Day moment.
It is a big day today in Paraguay because for the first time in 60 years, it looks like they're going to have a new leader and a leader from the opposition party. And this was a race between what would have been the first woman president in the country's history and a male candidate calling for change. Themes, obviously, a bit familiar here in the United States.
More than a century of history here, actually.
Yeah, seek a Democratic presidential race. The historic results in Paraguay began trickling in last night, and the country could face its first peaceful transition since 1811, when the Spanish gave up power. Tom Hennigan of the Times of London, what's the reaction there as they're counting votes in Paraguay?
Well, they're still going to be counting for the Congress, but late last night, Fernando Lugo, a former Catholic bishop, the opposition leader, was declared the new president of Paraguay. And it was an historic occasion. Thousands of people flooded out onto the streets to celebrate. It's the first time in 62 years that there will be a change of power. The Colorado Party has ruled Paraguay since the 1940s. And it's also, as you pointed out, the first ever peaceful transfer of power since the country's independence from Spain.
And what is happening there that allowed for this seeming result?
Well, one of the main reasons behind it was the ruling Colorado Party have turned Paraguay into one of the world's most corrupt countries, and the robbing of the public coffers by the ruling class is as blatant as anywhere else in South America, and they've pretty much devoted their political careers to lining their own pockets and doing nothing for the people, with the result that Paraguay, which should be a prosperous country, it has an amazingly fertile land, it has a great potential in hydropower, and yet its people are amongst the poorest in the Americas. And the candidate who won, Fernando Lugo, what he managed to do was finally unite the opposition around the idea of getting the Colorados out of power. So his coalition contains groups from the traditional conservative right through to the extreme left, but they all got together, finally managed to get together to get this Colorado Party out of power.
So the strong hand of the ruling party, given the context you just provided, makes these results all the more remarkable, correct? I mean, there was a tremendous amount of talk about violence, about accusations of fraud. These results will be certified in 10 days. Any concern that violence will bubble up or that there's going to be some major investigations as to whether or not any fraud did occur?
Well, we were out in some rural polling stations yesterday, and we came across some denunciations of fraud, but they were all the opposition saying that it was being practiced by the Colorado Party. But what happened was that there was a huge turnout, over 65% came out to vote, and that seems to have eliminated any sort of fears that a fraud could have stolen the opposition's victory. There definitely would have been fraud. Democracy in Paraguay is a fragile institution, and the reality is that with the 65% turnout, that the Colorados realized, look, the game is up, we just have to give up. And so they did concede, maybe not as gracefully as they might have, mm-hmm. but they did concede last night. They did recognize the opposition victory. So there is no doubt that Fernando Lugo on August 15th will be inaugurated the country's new president. How easy the Colorados make that transition has yet to be seen.
Okay, a new day in Paraguay. Tom Hennigan, Times of London. Thanks very much.
You know, I guess the question really there is Paraguay in sync with other transitions that are taking place to the left in South America, or is it, as it's always been, a bit of an anomaly? It's an important thing we'll be watching. In other news, and right here in the United States, this morning we have a new cry for help from U.S. military veterans. Soldiers returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, the availability of mental health care services has been in a crisis for them for years. Veterans have experienced reduced access to doctors compared to a decade ago, at the same time as one in three returning combat veterans is believed to be in need of actual clinical help. For those at risk of suicide, and there are believed to be tens of thousands of those, the VA has a suicide hotline.
If you are in emotional distress or suicidal crisis, or are concerned about someone who might be, the Lifeline is here to help. If you are a U.S. military veteran, or if you're calling about a veteran, please press 1 now.
Please hold while we connect your call.
And in our call this morning, a voice answered that music after less than 30 seconds. But a class action lawsuit that opens today in California charges that this hotline and other VA suicide prevention services are woefully inadequate. It's a system-wide breakdown, according to the plaintiffs. 18 veterans kill themselves each day, according to court documents. Patricia Cohen of the New York Times, you're covering this lawsuit. Do the veterans have a real case here, and how can they change the system in a civil suit in court?
Hi. Well, the suit comes after decades of unhappiness with the way that the VA has been responding to veterans who are disabled, both physically and mentally. And of course, this backlog has increased terribly since returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan have come on and added to the system. So it's been a long time in coming. One thing, though, that the VA has been responding to over in regard to recent months, though, is by putting up the suicide hotline as a way of at least presenting some help immediately for people in crisis.
What's been the response to the hotline?
Well, it's only been up and running since August, so it's very new. They've had in that first 8 months more than 32,000 calls and what they call 720 rescues. And what I mean by rescues is at the time that somebody calls and is immediately talking about suicide, from being on a bridge to having a bottle of pills in their hands, they will get in contact with local emergency responders and send somebody out and have brought those people safely into a hospital.
Is there any sense of how many times their interventions have been successful or not? I mean, I do notice from court papers that of those 18 veterans who kill themselves each day, a quarter of them are actually under the care of the VA when they kill themselves.
Well, it's very difficult to say. I mean, those numbers are very hard to pinpoint exactly between who is calling and who is getting help in the system. I mean, clearly most veterans actually aren't even under the care of the VA. This is meant to be an emergency hotline, so obviously there's limits of what they can do. The calls are anonymous, but for the people who do call and agree to get help, there is an attempt at least to make sure these people don't fall through the cracks and follow, and so that the VA follows through on giving service.
I mean, it's incredibly tragic here. I mean, we were discussing this morning the tone of the hotline. I mean, to even have recorded music there. I mean, I know you can't get somebody on the line immediately. Just, I mean, I'm thinking of some guy with a gun in his mouth and listening to that music and a recorded
right.
message.
But,
I mean, it's just frightening. I mean, I got to be fair to the VA, but still, ooh.
Right. Although, just to explain something about the hotline, what this is a national suicide prevention hotline that deals with everyone in the country.
Right.
So the idea is when that hotline comes on, veterans can get routed specifically to help that is geared towards veterans. And a lot of the people who are responding on the hotline are veterans or have worked for the VA for a long time.
Well, let's focus back on this case here for a second. We don't have a whole lot of time here. What can the court do? Can it enjoin the Veterans Administration? Is there some sort of force services? How does that work?
Well, that's the big question that's going to be decided in the court, because what the VA is saying is that the court doesn't have any right to tell the VA exactly how to do its services. So that's one of the points on which the VA is going to be challenging the lawsuit.
And this is a class action suit. So how many veterans are part of the plaintiffs?
Well, you know, there's two veterans groups that are basically bringing the lawsuit, and they are bringing it on behalf of all veterans. So that's every veteran, every former soldier who has served. I think there's one alive since World War I. And so it's everybody in the U.S.
Well, Patricia Cohen of the New York Times, thank you very much. As we said, the case is going to court today in California, and there'll be a story in the New York Times this week about that case. Thank you very much.
No, it is really disturbing. I've been covering this story for years. There were so many people early on after the Afghan war who were very concerned about the amount of money that the was being spent on the mental health of troops, and obviously even that much more serious now. So we will continue to follow that story. Also today, we're going to look at the nation's petroleum reserves. There's a growing debate over how the U.S. should use them in an age of record oil prices. We're also talking to people who think setting up clotheslines in your backyard can help slow global warming.
It can.
Yes. Tell us the moment when you change your behavior to be a more climate change conscious person.
When did you put up that
hybrid card, using less water, recycling? Tell us your story. What are you doing? My take
turning
at the takeaway.org, turning off your light.
But we want the story. We want the story.
No
opinion. We want a story.
So
when did you change your life?
Let me tell them where. The takeaway.org or at 8778 my take.
You can email us at talkback@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 800-543-2543.
543-2543.
We have lots more headlines. Femi Oke is here with them. Femi.
Hello, Adora. In the top stories we're following, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is in Bahrain after her surprise trip to Baghdad, and President Bush travels to New Orleans for the North American Leaders Summit. Elsewhere in the nation, oil is now $117 a barrel. OPEC pushed for the price hike after a pipeline attack in Nigeria at the weekend. Authorities begin taking DNA samples today from parents and over 400 children who were living in a Mormon compound in Texas. A judge ordered the testing to help sort out family relationships that have confused authorities. New Mexico officials have been asking the residents of two towns just southeast of Albuquerque to leave as wildfires blow between them. No one has been reported injured yet, but officials say gusty winds could send the blaze dangerously close to residential areas. And if you're in Illinois this morning, you may have been shaken out of bed by a 4.5 earthquake. The quake shook the southern state, half of the state, following more quakes over the weekend.
Yeah, and there have been second quake in 2 days.
Yeah, 15 aftershocks.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah, and 4.5 and 5 that they had on Friday, these are the kind of earthquakes that you really can feel.
That's something. The polygamy thing is driving me crazy.
It's
fascinating. The ACLU, I think, has weighed in on that now. The ACLU has actually weighed in on behalf of the women in the polygamous compound.
And 400 children. That's remarkable.
Yeah, and they're essentially concerned with the process, making sure that the families, the children and the women, they are getting their due process in court. And the ACLU is not convinced that they are.
Yeah, I'm not convinced either. But, you know, I'm just watching from afar. Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome. See you later.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji. Produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Stunning news out of Asia this morning, which is the price of oil has spiked to a record $117 a barrel. This happening after an attack on a key pipeline in Nigeria, which, of course, is a major exporter. Now, as these prices skyrocket, the Bush administration's policy of stockpiling oil is raising some eyebrows. And the program kind of works like this. Oil's pumped out of the ground from Nigeria and Saudi Arabia and Russia, among other countries. It's shipped to the U.S. We pay record prices for it, and then the administration pumps some of it right back into the ground, storing record numbers of barrels, roughly 700 million today. Does that make sense? Some people wonder. Now, given what's happening in the geopolitical universe with the wars and all of the tensions and the food global prices, what's driving this policy? Stephen Lieb is the author of The Oil Factor. Stephen?
Yes, I'm here.
So why is the United States stockpiling hundreds of millions of barrels of oil?
Well, you do, as you put it so well, it does make you wonder. And especially makes you wonder because the economy's been under a lot of pressure. We all know about the subprime crisis. We know about worries about inflation, which is compounding, all the pressures from some lost jobs. We know about the economy generally being weak. Why would the president then be adding oil to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve when that would only raise oil prices, wouldn't lower them?
Well, and some people apparently are wondering if perhaps there's a geopolitical catastrophe in our future. Is that just over-the-top thinking?
No, I don't think it is. I mean, if you just look at there are two possibilities here that really haven't been mentioned. One is Saudi Arabia's oil production appeared to have peaked about 3 or 4 years ago. In other words, despite the fact that the country has massive numbers of rigs there, more than they've ever had, their oil production has not exceeded 9.5 million barrels for at least 4 or 5 years. Russia's oil production has peaked. There are attacks on the Nigerian pipeline, which you pointed out earlier. Who knows how serious these things could become? If they become very, very serious, then we definitely will need the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. I mean, it's not just...
But do we need that much? And I guess that's really the question, and this has clearly become a campaign issue. Let's just very quickly listen to what Senator John McCain had to say.
Right now, I think we should stop adding... We should stop adding to the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. With oil at over $100 a barrel... And an adequate supply in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, it's time to suspend purchases. This will lessen the worldwide demand for oil, and if the classic laws of supply and demand hold, we should see a welcome decrease in the price of oil.
So, Stephen, should the Bush administration stop stockpiling?
If they know something that John McCain doesn't know, no. Clearly, what this illustrates, and it really is a major contrast with what you saw in year 2000. In year 2000, when President Clinton was president, we had a lot of cold weather in the fall, and Clinton released oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to temporarily lower prices. That would be a very easy step for the president to take today, and it would take pressure off the economy. So the fact that he doesn't, the fact that he's acting contrary to the wishes of the Republican Party, a party that's obviously on the defensive, strongly suggests to me that he may know something. Something may be happening that the public just is not aware of, and he doesn't want to make the public aware of it.
But Stephen, can I just ask a really simple question here?
Sure.
I mean, they call it the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Given that the oil started out in the ground and gets pumped back into the ground, is it really a reserve? And what is strategic about it?
Well, strategic about it is that it's a rainy day reserve.
But rainy...
If, for instance, tomorrow or you were to wake up today and find that the Saudi Arabian oil fields had been attacked... you would be taking 9 million barrels off the market.
Yeah, but how long is it going to last?
It would last, oh, well, if you use the entire reserve, if you use it to supply all the oil that the U.S. needs.
21 million barrels a day, right?
Right, so that you would have, well, you import about 10, so you would have about 70 days. And that might give you enough time to, you know, remedy whatever.
To drive down to the store and buy some guns or something, I guess.
Well.
No, but Stephen, let's just get back to one basic fact. The U.S., this reserve was formed in 1975, after all of the severe oil shortages during the 73 and 74 oil embargo. But today, we're not necessarily in the exact same situation. And is the fact that we are, in the United States, stockpiling those barrels of oil, is that affecting the price here in the United States.
I would say it's definitely affecting it, but not by a lot. I mean, we're only adding about 40,000 barrels a day from my calculations, which is, you know, a pittance compared to 20 million barrels a day we consume. But it certainly is putting added pressure. I mean, every bit of oil you consume does add pressure. And it's just not what you would expect during a campaign year. In fact, it's, you know, it would be close to political suicide. And that's why you had Senator McCain screaming when oil was at $100. Now it's at 116, over almost 117 this morning. So it doesn't make any political sense. And when you have a very political president, and all presidents are very political, or at least most are, acting in a very non-political way, you have to scratch your head and say, what does he know? Now, you know, the worst case scenario, and I'm not predicting this at all, I'm saying the worst case scenario is that this administration plans to do something in Iran, and they feel that they desperately will need this extra oil to get them through that period in which Iran would stop pumping oil. I don't believe that. I hope it's not true.
I think there's a lot of people hoping that's not true, but clearly the verdict would be out on this. Very, very quickly, Stephen Leeb, economist and author of The Oil Factor, have you changed your behavior? Are you more climate conscious today than you have been, and how?
Well, I'm
10 seconds.
I am more climate conscious. I conserve oil not just for the climate, but because we're going to need every drop of oil we need in order to build alternative energy infrastructure in this country. That's what the country has to be doing, and unfortunately, we're going to need fossil fuels to do it.
Okay.
All right, Stephen. It sounds like you have your own strategic petroleum reserve there, somewhere in your basement. Thank you very much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Femi Okay is here with some more headlines for us. What's happening?
In our lead stories today, the Pope is back in Italy and President Bush is talking trade with Canada and Mexico in New Orleans and making news elsewhere in the world. A former bishop becomes Paraguay's new head of state. Mr. Lugo won the elections after 6 decades of one-party rule. Former President Jimmy Carter says the Palestinian militant group Hamas is prepared to accept the right of Israel to, I quote, live as a neighbor next door in peace, end of quote. Hamas says it won't necessarily accept the results of any Palestinian referendum on peace with Israel. The Bank of England is to pump $100 billion into the British banking system to help it cope with the effects of the subprime mortgage crisis in the United States. And finally, if you have to say sorry, why not turn it into a song?
As Prime Minister of Australia, I am sorry. On behalf of the government,
Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd's apology to Aborigines for past injustices has been turned into a song. I think I'll be dancing to this one. Rudd's words feature at the start of the song, which adapts a hit ballad, "From Little Things, Big Things Grow." That's your news for this hour.
Thank you, Femi. It's an Aussie invasion.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. We're following stories of record oil prices, $117 a barrel, and other important stories happening in the Middle East today. And Adora, in our mission in this segment is to talk about the environment, but to do it in a playful, relaxed way, because I think that's the best way for people to actually take action and help the climate. Yes, relax. That's right.
Okay.
We have with us Dan Ninen, who's a comedian and a green activist based here in New York. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here.
And this weekend, Adora, I had my kids climb some trees and tie some knots.
You were trying to get them tuckered
nope,
out. Sleep well.
Nope, they were putting a clothesline up for their grandma at our property. And my mother-in-law is desperate to get a clothesline up because it saves her energy to not use the dryer. And of course, as everyone knows, clothes that are dried in the wind are just that much fresher. They're much better. In honor of Earth Day, which is tomorrow,
I'll take your word for it.
We're looking for green impulses everyone can agree on. But you know, Alex Lee, who's an environmental consultant and the founder of Project Laundry List, says that oddly enough, and Dan, you may be surprised by this, drying your clothes on an old-fashioned clothesline is turning neighbor against neighbor in some communities. This is a controversial issue. Alex, where are clotheslines causing controversy, and how much energy do you think they save?
Well, I wouldn't say that first about the clothesline because I'm hearing more and more that it's a chic thing. But it's happening in, for instance, Bend, Oregon. On the front page of the Wall Street Journal last September, there's a story of a woman who couldn't hang out her clothes because her community association, and there are 300,000 community associations in the United States that are home to 60 million Americans, told her that she could not hang out her clothes. And most of those community associations do the same thing. They either restrict it or they ban it.
So it's like a zoning ordinance or something?
By ordinance and by in municipalities, and then by bylaws and CC&Rs, they're called, in community associations.
Well, how much energy is at stake here if we were to actually use clotheslines even close to the frequency to which they were used in the earlier part of this century, before there were dryers?
You mean ubiquitously?
ubiquitously. Except on rainy days.
It's interesting. The federal government statistic is 5.8% of residential electricity use, but that doesn't take into account the 17 million Americans with gas dryers, which is 16% of the households in the U.S. And that doesn't take into account people who go to laundromats or multifamily housing laundry, and it certainly doesn't take into account any of the commercial laundry done at jails, prisons, hospitals, where we house millions of people.
So it's actually enormous.
It's actually enormous.
Isn't there
appliance after the refrigerator, but an Energy Star refrigerator is more conservative than a dryer because a dryer is by nature inefficient.
Well, Alex, let's look into the constitutional question here, okay?
Yeah.
Speech is protected in the Constitution, right?
Yeah.
Money is speech, according to Supreme Court decisions, right?
Yeah.
Is not laundry, which is paid for with money, speech, and therefore protected? If I hang out my laundry, it's an act of speech. Right.
I started Project Laundry List in 1995, and our whole concept was to hang clothes out on a line with speech actually written on them about power plants and making that connection between the, every time you turn on that dryer, you're demanding that we build a new power plant, or maybe not every time, but every time that we do it collectively.
All right, so what's the mission of Project Laundry List, and what do you hope to accomplish? Any success? I actually love what you're talking about here, and we use clotheslines on our property.
One is to have a different approach to environmentalism. Instead of, you know, let's not build a nuclear power plant, which I don't think is a good idea, and let's not build large hydro projects, which I also don't think is a good idea. It's, hey, let's do something that's good for us, that makes your clothes last longer, smell better, saves you money, gets you outside, and connects you with your neighborhood.
And it does wonders for the clothespin industry, correct?
That's right. Actually, yeah. There's no wooden clothespin manufactured in the United States anymore, though.
Yeah, well, see, there you go. I mean, this is an industrial resurgence, also a climate change impulse. Alex, thank you very much for joining us.
Appreciate it.
Alex Lee, founder of Project Laundry List, who reminds us that last Saturday on the 19th of April was National Hangout Day.
That could mean so many things.
Yeah, well, what'd you do? Did you hang out? Did you hang out any clothes?
Did you hang out any clothes?
Dan, what do you think? If you're going to celebrate Earth Day tomorrow, all right, you're in a hotel room, Tell me the steps that you would do to celebrate Earth Day.
Oh, there's a million things you can do. The first thing I do is, you know, I hang out the Do Not Disturb sign for two reasons. I don't want them coming in and, you know, messing with my electronic gear like my laptop and so on. And the other thing I do is, you know, I don't have the sheets made up every day. I don't have the towels replaced every day because I don't do that at home. I do it, you know, maybe once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks.
You do laundry once a week, whether it needs it or not, kind of in your house?
Roughly once a week. Well, you know, for the sheets, you know, every week, maybe 2 weeks, maybe longer than I should admit. But, you know,
it's really nice that you're unburdening yourself. I should remind people that Dan Ninen is a comedian and green activist based here in New York. Anyway, continue your celebration of Earth Day here.
Certainly turning the lights off. You know, I unplug the TV. I'm pretty crazy about it. I don't watch the
television. Every time you leave, you unplug the television?
No, I don't ever watch the TV at all, so I'm a little bit weird. But, you know, the TV, the instant on feature takes up so much energy, and I unplug that. I unplug the fridge if there is one, if I'm not using it.
The refrigerator? Is there food inside?
No. There's
in the hotel.
It's a hotel fridge.
Yeah, it's always empty.
Hotel fridge, yeah.
Not confused there.
No.
Do you go down the hall and turn out the lights in the hallway or tell other people to turn off their lights?
I wish, you know, if you've traveled in Europe or Asia a lot, you'll see that the hall lights turn off automatically if no one's come by in about 10 minutes. The escalators turn off automatically.
You're really right. I was in London and I noticed that about 2 months ago.
Right.
The lights, I said, huh, where's the switch? And it didn't. As soon as you walked out there, boom, the light came on.
How did you get on this traveler environmental gig?
I've actually been, you know, I know that we've reached a tipping point in environmentalism, which is fantastic, but I've been like this since like third grade, and I would use both sides of the piece of paper. My mom's from Japan. You know, they're like, you know, she lived through the war. They use glue. They use rice, you know, for glue. I mean, they reuse everything. In Japan right now, I think there's 22 categories of recycling. So I've always been this way, and I remember when the energy crisis hit, my father sat us down and said, listen, we have to do our part to conserve. I mean, you know, they keep their thermostat. It's like boiling in the summer and freezing in the winter.
Sounds like my parents' house.
Now, people who are sticklers for environmentalism aren't known to have, like, extraordinary sense of humor. I mean, these are not the chuckleheads of the world who are running around turning off the lights. How can you survive as a comedian and be such a stickler?
Well, I think, you know, of course, for my job, I have to travel a lot, and there's nothing I can do about that. I have to fly on planes. However, I was offered a private jet for a show, and I said, listen, I just, on good conscience, I can't do that. I have to turn that down. I think just, you know, everyone can do, you know, for example, when I rent a car, when I have to rent a car, which I try to avoid, you know, I always try to get a Prius. I'm always carrying rechargeable batteries. You know, Americans throw away billions of batteries, and I have these 15-minute rechargeables, use them over and over, and it also saves money.
Where do you stand on the clothesline debate? Are you pro-clothesline?
Totally pro-clothesline. I mean, you know, it's a new era. I mean, we have to, you know, I think that, yes, sure, some people might think it's an eyesore, but I think it's just we have to take steps like that.
Well, it depends. Depends on the laundry. You know, it depends on laundry. I mean, you know, that's a judgment there. But here's a question for you. When you do stand-up, do you ever ask the house to, like, not turn on your mic?
No.
To save power?
I have to have a mic sometimes in front of 2,000 people.
Good call. Dan Ninen, thank you very much. You're going to stick around, right?
Absolutely.
All right, great.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, provoking discussion about what it means to do the right thing.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. You know, first of all, Dan Ninen is with us, our buddy, green activist.
Hello
and
again.
And also Adora's with me here. It was one of those beautiful spring days last week in the rolling hills of Pennsylvania. And Jim Colgan, our producer, and me decided to pull off the road and visit the Cabela's in Hamburg, Pennsylvania. Ever been to a Cabela's?
No.
This is not an environmental center, okay? It's a giant outfitters. They sell guns there. They even have a gun library there. They have big stuffed animals. I think we're something like, you know, 50 animals had to die and be stuffed beyond the walls at this place. They sell tents, camouflage, all this sort of thing. Well, we stopped at the Cabela's in Hamburg, just off the interstate, and took a few minutes and took the political pulse of the Keystone State. Here you go.
Well, what do you think about the primary? Who do you think is going to win, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama?
Hopefully neither.
Yeah, well, one of them actually
Barack
has
Obama.
To win.
Yeah? Barack Obama will win.
Personally, I don't believe a word coming out of Hillary's mouth.
So you don't believe her grandpa taught her how to shoot or anything, that story?
Not for half a second.
But a lot of people are saying Obama is going to get the Cabela's vote.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is the case?
I think because of Hillary Clinton's stance in New York State as a governor. She tried to control the guns.
When was she the governor of New York?
Wasn't she the governor?
Ouch. Actually, he did finally correct himself and say he was the senator. But a lot of political cynicism there at the Cabela's.
I think there's a lot of political cynicism a lot of places, but there's also a tremendous amount of excitement because Pennsylvania tomorrow is holding the primary, the Democratic presidential primary, and it's a tight contest,
yes,
right?
It is a tight contest, and I think the divisions in the electorate were evident, even if political expertise was not terribly evident with these folks at Cabela's, who are real voters with real guns.
What kind of gun do you think Hillary Clinton carries?
Probably none.
But if she did carry one, what would it be?
A little dinky pistol or something.
How about Barack Obama?
Probably a nice shotgun.
Nice shotgun?
Sawed off, yeah.
Sawed off?
Yeah. He
really?
Seems like that kind of dude. He's real calm until it comes time to do something, I think.
What kind of gun do you think Hillary Clinton carries? What gun goes with Hillary Clinton?
I don't know. Some type of deer rifle, I would imagine.
Deer rifle, yeah. But not a BB gun.
Can you go BB gun? I would say BB gun.
You'd say BB gun, then. Sure, you can go BB gun. What's a Hillary Clinton gun?
Flamethrower.
Flamethrower? Or what's a Barack Obama gun?
M16.
M16?
No, I'm not a big Hillary fan.
Not a big Hillary fan. All right, you going to vote?
No, I actually haven't voted since I've been in high school.
You voted in high school?
Yep, that's it.
How did that work?
Well, I voted as soon as I was able to vote.
I see. All right. Take care.
Yep, sir. Have fun.
Some patrons of the Cabela's outside Hamburg, Pennsylvania.
What did you say? He said I voted in high school
yeah.
And you said,
how'd that work? Yeah, well, maybe high school was a little long for him. Anyway, we're going to have real campaign news with Andrea Bernstein coming up in the next segment. Also, people have been telling us their
stories
of going green, the moment they went green. For you, Dan, it was like in third grade, right?
I think it was from very early on, yes.
Yeah, for me, it was in junior high school in Syracuse, New York.
And we have Ronaldo Ramirez, who tells us, happened recently when I realized I could work and I just lost my place. I apologize. That's live radio, folks.
Yeah, well, anyway, the stories are being told at mytake@thetakeaway.org, the story of when you changed and the earth changed with you.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji, produced in collaboration with the BBC World Service, New York Times Radio, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Time for some more headlines. Femi Okeh is here with them. What do you have?
Good morning. In two of the top stories we're looking at today, authorities conducting DNA testing on more than 400 children from a Mormon compound in Texas because they're confused by the family relationships, and oil reaches $117 a barrel. In your sports headlines, IndyCar racer Danuka Patrick has made history. She's the first woman to win an IndyCar race. She won at the Indy Japan 300. Super Bowl MVP Eli Manning is off the market. The New York Giants quarterback married his college sweetheart over the weekend in Mexico. More troubles follow the Olympic torch as it begins its trip to Malaysia. Police say they arrested a Japanese family who were waving a pro-Tibet banner during the torch run. LeBron James led Cleveland to a 93-86 victory over the Washington Wizards as the NBA playoffs got underway this weekend. Today, the Cleveland hosts Washington and Utah plays in Houston. And finally, to sport of a different kind, this is the sound of female fruit flies courting. I hate to interrupt them. Sorry about that. Scientists have genetically modified fruit
me on.
Flies.
Really?
It's the wing rubbing.
Whoa.
Ooh, yeah,
ooh.
Baby.
Yeah. Eli Manning, no longer a free agent. Ooh, fruit flies going wild.
Scientists have genetically modified fruit flies so the females act like males. So they are now producing courtship songs and apparently buying pints of beer.
Right. Thank you, Femi.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Another story that we are following really closely today is the presidential, the Pennsylvania Democratic primary. Boy, it's no laughing matter.
No.
It's a big deal there in Pennsylvania. Their votes will matter like never before. And while some people are complaining about how long this is taking to get a Democratic nominee,
it is taking a
people
while.
In the Keystone State, well, they're all state are all revved up. The registration rolls are on an all-time high. And, John, get this. Democrats have picked up 326,000 new voters from a year ago. Tomorrow is the big way. And joining us is Takeaway political correspondent Andrea Bernstein, also known as the WNYC political director, who is just back from Philadelphia. Andrea, let's get right to the basics. Now, Senator Hillary Clinton is leading rival Barack Obama in polls anywhere from 3 to 14 points. Clearly, this is a critical contest for Clinton. What's her appeal to voters there?
Well, you know, throughout this campaign, Hillary Clinton has connected to the economically insecure voters. That is now a growing category of Americans. So while we're not really getting more women in the population or more African Americans, people who are worried about the economy, there are more of them. And they, you know, I was in northeastern Pennsylvania, and they loved Hillary Clinton there. They loved her there almost more than any place I've ever seen her. They feel like she is somebody they can rely on to get it done.
Bottom line, she is behind Barack Obama, not only in the delegate count, but also in the popular vote. Let's take a quick listen to what her strategist, her chief strategist, Jeff Garin, had to say on Meet the Press yesterday.
The superdelegates, as they're called, are not, this is not about a backroom deal. These are people who are elected officials. They are elected party representatives. They're going to, in the clear light of day, both candidates, I think, will make a case to them about why they are the best choice for the party and for the country. But the reality is that neither candidate will have enough pledged delegates when the last votes are cast on June 3rd, and we will go from there.
Andrea, what's your sense? Is this something that the pundits just discussed, or is this something that voters in Pennsylvania are thinking about?
Oh, I don't think they care about the superdelegates. I mean, what's amazing to me is each state that I've gone to in this election, people are actually drilling down into the candidates, into the issues, and they are so excited to have their opportunity to vote. And you'll find a very different attitude in, say, the sort of New York, New Jersey area than you will, for example, in the Pennsylvania area. In a state that's already voted, people will say, oh, I'm so sick of it. But when you go to Pennsylvania, people are thrilled to have the opportunity, and feel like they are making a real difference. They feel like they're really getting to have a say. Now, whether all the math will work out in the end that way is still a bit up in the air, but people in Pennsylvania believe they are contributing to this process.
Okay, Andrea Bernstein, a big day to come for Pennsylvanians tomorrow. Many thanks.
Thank you.
And it will be a big day.
Indeed. Meanwhile, the record high prices for wheat, rice, and corn are bringing governments around the world to the brink of political instability. With little economic flexibility in a 6-billion-person world, some economists are looking to changing the global diet. Did you know that the UN declared 2008 the International Year of the Potato? The legume is a hidden treasure of abundant calories and high-quality nutrition. Dr. Pamela Anderson is the Director General of the International Potato Center in Lima, Peru. She joins us this morning. Dr. Anderson, can the potato really substitute for spiking staples like rice and wheat?
It's not a matter of substituting. It's a matter of complementing. What we're seeing with these price rises is, as the World Bank president told us this week, 100 million people in addition to the 830 million people that are already hungry at risk. And those are mostly people in the low-income food deficit countries. So you need to look at internal, not imported, food supplies, and potato really is going to be part of the solution as we have to deal with this global food crisis.
What places in the world could rely on potatoes as a complement to existing staples?
It's countries that are already doing it. This is a trend that we have been seeing over the last decade. For the first time in 2005, potatoes have had higher production in the developing countries than in the industrialized countries, and that includes China, India, and sub-Saharan Africa. You have potatoes expanding more rapidly than any other food staple crop, and of course in the Andean chain of South America. So in a lot of your poverty belts around the world, countries and small farmers are already turning to potatoes. This is a trend that has been taking off in the last decade, and what is going to happen, I suspect, with these rising food prices is this trend will accelerate.
Aren't there disease and storage problems with potatoes that limit their ability to help in this global food crisis?
I wouldn't say that they limit. There are definitely problems that we're dealing with, and this is the reason why we need to be so vigilant about investments in agricultural research. The most important potato disease is still the disease called potato late blight, which caused the Irish potato famine. We are still struggling with that, and if we can manage that disease and if we can guarantee supply of clean seed, which means disease-free seed, you can often see yields increase up to 30%.
Well, so that's really interesting. The more research. Things change, the more they stay the same, particularly as far as food is concerned. Dr. Pamela Anderson, Director General of the International Potato Center in Lima, Peru. Thank you very much. You know, Dora, I was reading that the food crisis has changed people's orientation to genetically modified food.
Oh, I think so, because the problem seems so enormous, and each week there's a new development. So the question is, what kind of solutions can be put forth? And I think that the doctor there, Pamela, made a really good point, which is they all have to be used.
Right,
it isn't just one answer. It's just not growing more wheat or something.
So tell us the moment when you changed your behavior to a more climate-conscious person. You can leave your story at mytake at thetakeaway.org or at 877-8-MYTAKE. One of our responses, I know this seems corny, but when my grandchild was born, all of a sudden, the future of the earth seemed to matter.
Not corny at all. And here's one from John Doe. A friend of mine with whom I canoe a lot pointed out that we don't see so many turtles anymore. I found out that the small change in temperature that we've already seen has made it so that some turtles can't reproduce. And Dan, your girlfriend, you lost her over these issues? You were trying to be a good environmental citizen and she wasn't?
Yeah, we were at the Hyatt Regency in Kauai, and then I said, look, we got to turn the TV off and the lights, when we leave the room, right? And she's like, why? You're not paying for it. And I couldn't understand that attitude, And needless to say, we're not going out anymore.
That's Dan Ninen, a comedian and green activist. That was no funny matter.
Ouch, man.
Was it? Sounds tough.
It's tough. What's she doing now? She's like burning harp seals in a wood stove or something?
Who knows? But in Asia, I was.
Goodness.
You have to stick your key in the slot in order for the lights to come on. And when you leave the room, you take your key out, all the lights automatically go off. They should do that at hotels in America.
They should. Yeah. They should do that. We shouldn't have these lights on in the studio. Actually, I think the lights should not be on in the studio.
Okay, John. All right. Yeah. Okay.
So keep those responses coming to thetakeaway.org. Tell us your efforts to be environmentally correct. Earth Day is tomorrow. We're asking for photos. How are you marking the day of environmentalism? You can upload your green photos to thetakeaway.org.
And
you can take our Selectricity poll. Which way do you want to see the Democratic nomination settled? Here are the scenarios. Clinton drops out, Obama drops out, Gore comes in, or the party forces an outcome before the convention, or we wait for a showdown. Anyway, you can register your preferences at thetakeaway.org.
And that's our Selectricity poll, right?
That's correct.
That's a very interesting tool. And we've also linked to a recent piece in New York Magazine where a writer for The West Wing wrote a dramatic scenario of the convention cliffhanger. You got to check this out. It's brilliant. Al Gore, he plays a role. Barack Obama, Senator Clinton. Check it out. It's compelling.
Dan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right.
Appreciate it.
Take
care.
We'll see you tomorrow.
Major funding for The Takeaway is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, with additional funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, the Skoll Foundation, the Henry Luce Foundation, the Freeman Foundation, and the Star Foundation. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.